Today's episode of Beyond the Mask is presented by the team at CRNA Financial Planning. Get a free consultation today to be guided through the complexities of investing and financial planning. Just visit crnafinancialplanning.com. Beyond the Mask is also sponsored by crnaeducation.com. CRNAs, you can get the CE credits you need by just going to crnaeducation.com. They have over 100 AANA prior approved credits, all four core CPC modules, and even over 40 pharmacology credits. No subscriptions, it's all online and mobile friendly. Just go to crnaeducation.com. And don't forget, listening to our podcast can earn you Class B credits. For more information on how you can submit them, check out our CE credit tab on our website, beyondthemaskpodcast.com. Welcome to Beyond the Mask, innovation and opportunities for CRNAs and advanced practice nurses, with certified financial planner Jeremy Stanley and CRNA Sharon Pierce. Jeremy Stanley has worked with CRNAs for more than 23 years, and Sharon Pierce is a former president of the AANA and the NCANA. Join us as we leave the operating room and learn the latest in the CRNA and advanced practice nurse industries. Beyond the Mask starts in 10, 9, 8, 7.
Good morning, Miss Pierce. How you feeling this morning?
Why do you ask me that?
Well, I just wondered. I didn't know how late you stayed out last night.
Well, we are at the NCANA meeting in Charleston, South Carolina, and we are at a fabulous venue. And
they do have a rooftop bar.
They have. I know that because I was there pretty late last night. And it was beautiful out there. The wind
the sunset,
was blowing. Oh. I didn't see the sunset.
No,
I was
you didn't.
Still inside.
People were sending me pictures of it.
That's how I knew
you were there.
Well,
they were like, oh, Sharon's here.
Well, I was at the PAC event, of course, which I have to go to that. Then we went to the rooftop bar, and so the sun had already gone down. But I didn't stay there till the sun came up. Oh, gosh, she's showing me the pictures, and I didn't get to see it live. But my friend Dana Peterson, who's staying with me, we lost her for a little while. I felt like the hangover ride. Where did we leave Dana? She had gone to the room, gotten to bed.
Well, you know, Dana pulls those little Houdinis.
Yeah, so, she's done it to me before when we were having dinner, and I lost her after the salad. And I thought, where? I thought she went to the bathroom. And she went and got in the bed and called me to tell me to bring her entree to the room.
That's a good friend.
Oh,
you're
that
talking
is
about
a good
me.
Friend. Oh, well, I think we got another, I'm going to say, very interesting. You know, I didn't even know this was a thing. A very interesting podcast this morning.
Till I was prepping you for
it. You prepped me for it and then kind of looking at it. So we have with us this morning Adam Flo. Adam, welcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me back. It's
absolutely
good to be with you guys.
So we're going to let you tell a little bit about yourself. And for our listeners who might not know you, you've been on the show before. And then kind of tell us about this topic and why it's important.
Adam Flo, I'm 52, father of three. I've got two in college, one in high school.
In other words, you're busy.
Busy.
That's what
you're
saying.
We normally don't admit to our age on here, so good for you.
I have to own it. Chief CRNA at Duke. I think I'm now the longest serving Chief CRNA in the history of Duke Hospital.
Yeah. So that's saying something.
I've been at Duke for 20 years. I've been managing there for about 14. I've been the chief for almost 9.
That's a lot of stress. Yeah. How many CRNAs?
185 through the medical campus. There's another 70 or so at the other Duke hospitals.
Uh-huh. That's a lot of managing.
It's a big operation. We have 100 anesthesia locations starting every Monday morning.
Wow.
Sure.
That's why you don't last very long.
Well.
But you clearly have some.
I may also be the dumbest CRNA in the history of Duke Health, and I'll proudly own that as well. When ignorance is bliss.
Well, that'll cause you to lose your hair.
It did.
It did. Did you have hair before you started, Adam?
You know, as I've gotten older, there's several parts of my body that haven't worked quite as well. I would get my eyesight back first.
Okay. All right.
Yeah,
gotcha.
Before you
keep the hair. Let me have my eyes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know that feeling.
We get it.
So I love coming to NCNA. I mean, I love the educational part of it. I love the engagement part of it. I love the political discussion that happens as well. And I like bringing the Duke CRNAs here with us. We've got a great compliment this time, a lot of the presenters. Mm-hmm. And I just think it's awesome.
Yeah. There's a lot of Dookies.
So those who are listening and you've not been to the NCNA or a professional conference, you need to get there. You need to do those things to support your profession, including joining into the political activities, contributing to your PAC.
It's
absolutely
fun. Listen, I've gotten more back than I have given, and I've given a lot of time, treasure, to this organization, but it's given back to me tenfold what I've given it did, mostly finding friends and colleagues and meeting people like you. I mean, would our paths ever have crossed otherwise?
100% agree with you.
Yeah.
Maybe ours would have, because we recognize that we might be somewhere kin down along the lines here. So, you know, hey.
Jeremy is Jeremy Stanley, and my grandmother was Emily Stanley, who in part grew up in Stanleyville, just outside Winston-Salem, where Jeremy also lives.
You really could be related. It is the
crazy
South, man.
Yeah. And my dad's family's up towards Charlottesville, so all the Stanleys up there and so forth.
My family also spills into Virginia.
Okay. All right. See, there you go.
I'm seeing the resemblance now.
Spit in this cup, and we'll do the 23andMe and see if we really are. You know,
I have a lost brother right here in this building.
You know, people are finding that stuff out. I've got friends who found out that they've got siblings that daddy was a little wayward.
All righty then.
On with the show.
So what are we talking about today,
Adam? It's a topic I've been thinking about for a while now, and it's a little bit personal to me. I would tell you that perhaps my greatest fear in life is early onset dementia.
Yeah, and like, join the crowd.
How do I know? How am I going to tell if I'm starting to slip?
Right.
I grew up in a multi-generational household. My grandmother, Emily Stanley, and my other grandmother, Margaret Turner, lived with us. Both of them suffered from dementia and Alzheimer's.
Really?
They both did. Very challenging events for a family.
Yeah.
You lose them not once, but twice.
That's right.
Them before you lose
Sometimes
them.
Even more than twice. You know, they leave the home. They go to the nursing home. Things fall apart from there. They go to a memory care. Yeah. From memory care, they can't be maintained. They go to probably a less quality situation.
Well, somebody as ultra intelligent as you, it's a longer fall than for the best of us.
I'd like to start low. And there have been two children in my life who have suffered with neuroinflammatory conditions, like autoimmune encephalitis.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
One of whom died, unfortunately, when she was six, and another whom has gotten into her 30s. And her life is just altered. I'm not sure it's a path back.
Remember that movie that Robin Williams was in? Those people had encephalitis, right?
They did.
The Awakening, whatever.
Exactly what it was. Yeah, and it's a broad spectrum of conditions.
Yeah.
It's not just one thing. And there's
many. Movie I'm talking about.
It's called Awakening.
It was fabulous, and it was a true story.
Yes, and there's so many factors of the brain, like chemicals, antibodies, electrical pathways.
Yeah.
There's so many ways that things can go wrong.
Yeah.
We can't replicate the brain.
No, not easily.
We can through AI now. AI is going to do
it all,
right?
It's scary and exciting all at the same time, AI, but that's another topic. So we understand that this is personal. That's usually a reason why a lot of us come up with lectures. You know, I did diabetes all the time because my daughter was diagnosed when she was five. So we know why you're interested in it and why it's personal. So give us a little bit more.
In my own practice, I routinely take care of radiation oncology patients, is women coming in with uterine cancer typically, and they come for five visits requiring anesthesia. And over the past couple of years, I've seen two of them kind of drift away from us, like their engagement in life, their focus, they've altered. Their personality's altered during that month or two of them coming in for these treatments. And it really caused me to have some doubts, like, was there something I was doing that was somehow contributing to this change that they were experiencing that we could all witness, like the nurses, the doctors, we all saw it. One of them felt it. She knew something was happening.
Oh, no. That'd be even worse.
And being at Duke, one of the blessings of being at Duke is like it's a think tank kind of place, and there's experts from all kinds of disciplines there. And we actually have a little hotbed of researchers and doctors and nurses involved in study of the brain, in particular delirium and dementia. And so after I experienced these two patients, I went to one of them who I knew quite well and started asking questions. And that's really where the seeds for this presentation and came from. But along the way, I learned something I didn't expect to learn.
And that was?
That might not be the anesthesia.
Really?
That might not be the anesthesia. I mean, and
it might be.
Anesthesia, 100%, you can make somebody sleepy and confused and delirious. You give them enough sedatives and narcotics, 100%. But very quickly, scratching into this topic, which is a really hot and rich topic right now, you learn that there's this thing related to the surgery and to the trauma of the body. Trauma, whether it be some kind of unnatural trauma or trauma in the sense of surgery, mm-hmm. incisions of the body, the breaking of bones, potentially the removal of organs that trigger these biochemical pathways in the blood that seem to have a major role in this.
Interesting.
Well, the reason why I was interested in the topic whenever I was reviewing the titles, et cetera, my father had to have a thoracotomy, and he was a very hardy 76, 77-year-old. My daddy was very smart, and when he came home, he couldn't write. I mean, it looked like chicken scratch, and he was like Jeremy, could do all these, high-end math problems in his head. And he would sit and look at his checkbook, and he would say, Shay, I don't know what's wrong with me. That I can't. He couldn't even balance his checkbook. I mean, he had this true cognitive decline. Jeremy and I were talking about this. You know, Dean Smith's family firmly believes that his dementia, his Alzheimer's, whatever he had, began with an anesthetic. And they blamed anesthesia for his decline. And I never quite bought into it. And then I saw what happened to my father. And I don't have any answers. That's why I'm fascinated.
Common sense would say, of course, you gave medications that crossed the blood-brain barrier. They entered the brain. They entered the mind. They altered sensation. And somehow the person doesn't fully recover from that.
Right.
That seems totally intuitive. How could you argue against that?
Well, then the place that I work at, occasionally when in Rome, do as the Romans do, and they don't give people over 70 benzos.
Correct.
So I'd never thought about it. So I'm reluctant sometimes to do it because that's the way they do it. But yeah. I don't know if there's any backing to that.
There is. The American Society of Geriatrics maintains a list of medications, not just specific for anesthesia, but all medications. Mm-hmm. And they call it the Beers criteria,
okay.
B-E-E-R-S, which is another potential. It's a expert consensus panel that meets annually. They met in May this year, and they update the list. And they have three categories of highest risk to lowest risk for people. 65, there's some argument amongst their team, like, where's this age start? Is it 60, is it 65, is it 70? 65 seems to be where most people land.
Jesus, you are stepping all in
landmine here. I'm sorry.
Wow.
And there are some very common medications that we give in anesthesia that are on that list that deserve attention,
right,
and probably should be avoided if you don't have to give them. And benzodiazepines being a primary one of those. Mm-hmm. A lot of the antiemetics are on there. Reglan, Finnegan.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine.
Why do you think CRNA, what do you think about when CRNAs talk about brain protection? Is that being discussed?
It is, and that's one of the things I was hoping to drive home with my presentation, because I think the typical CRNA in their workhorse role of being in the operating room in front of that anesthesia machine, you tell them the term brain protection, I think they start thinking about craniotomies.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How am I going to reduce
insults
to the brain? How am I going to be neuroprotective of the brain? How am I going to reduce the mass of the brain so the surgeon can operate more within that closed chamber of the cranium? And there's techniques you can do with the ventilator, the choice of gas and medications. That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is the brain health after any surgery. The estimates for many, many studies for many years, somewhere between 10 and 20%, maybe as much as 25% of patients experience delirium. And then, that's that loss of orientation, agitation, sometimes defensiveness, sometimes belligerence.
They try to punch
dysphoria,
you.
Dysphoria, these done, negative feelings. And exactly. That typically resolves in hours to days. It's now seen in terms of a spectrum. There's now a neurocognitive delayed recovery that's the same kind of event taking up to 30 days.
And then
30 days.
Wow.
And then, unfortunately, about 1% of people with delirium go past 30 days. And that's where we start talking about a post-operative cognitive decline.
So this is bigger than emergence delirium. My husband has emergence delirium. Oh, my God.
And that's probably the anesthesia.
Yeah.
Emergence delirium is probably the anesthesia.
Oh, my God. He looks like the exorcist something flipping around on the bed whenever he wakes up.
Well, it's scary because the patient, without meaning to, could hurt themselves. They could pull out a drain. They could open their wound.
Well, he's a host. He's 6'3".
They could fall off the bed.
He could take anybody with him.
They could attack a nurse. I mean, there's lots of bad things that can happen from that emergency.
So I guess, first thought to my head is, the CRNA gives the anesthetic. They wake them up. They drop them off at PACU. They're done. So how is this being...
Good point.
How's it being tracked? I mean, you don't ever know this, right?
We don't. And American healthcare and sort of maybe the stresses of our productivity model don't allow for this very well.
That's a great way of putting it. The stresses of our productivity model. Oh, my God. I don't think I've ever heard it
spoken like the
like
chief
that.
At Duke
he
right
is.
There.
It's just true.
I mean, it's true.
Your attention is on the next patient.
I've never
absolutely.
Heard it put like that.
Turn it over and
you're
keep
awesome.
Going.
And there's not a huge professional expectation for that kind of follow-up. Most of the follow-up right. is actually from the surgeon. Even our anesthesiologist colleagues don't actually see the patients that often after the fact. And so it
right.
could well be that one step we could take as a healthcare industry is put some burden onto the surgeon to do some neurologic brain health assessment at the post-operative visit. That might be a way of...
In their 7 minutes that they
in
see
the 7 minutes. Well, I have to tack on
an
eighth minute, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
We are doing things that could be profoundly impactful to that patient, and yet we
right.
don't have awesome insight into that. Now, there
right.
are researchers, or like perioperative outcome researchers, looking at this.
Okay.
But I actually don't think their information is coming full circle back to the yeah. frontline providers as well as it should be.
Well, it almost seems like there needs to be another layer at some point with maybe older patients that, you know, there's a drop-off and then there's a tracking mechanism there to kind of track this. I don't, you know, I don't
sounds
know
like
what,
a good DMP project.
It would yeah. be an awesome DMP project.
Okay,
yeah.
kids
yeah.
out
yeah.
there I looking mean, for a project. Adam Flo, call
prospective
him
studies of brain health at the 2 week, 1 month, 2 month, 3 month.
Yes.
With cognitive testing, a mini mint, some sort of
you need
quantifiable
to tell that
test.
To your little dookie
I will.
Students.
I will.
Get them
I've talked to
this.
A couple of them yesterday.
Yeah. yeah. That would
yeah.
be a great,
it'd be
great
fantastic.
Study.
So can the CRNA have a better understanding of this?
Right.
Can the CRNA make in-the-moment choices at the time of the anesthesia to influence these outcomes, to prevent people from falling off that cliff, to go past that delirium, not go past those 30 days?
Right.
So what are those choices?
That's complicated. And that's where the story flipped on me. Because mm-hmm. I was trying to figure out, well, what is the net, like best combination of medications? What
sure.
medications should we avoid, like on the Beers criteria? And there are some studies out there suggesting, for instance, that Teva may be slightly better than gas, although that's not conclusive. There's mm-hmm. studies out there suggesting that ketamine and Precedex both might be promoting of cognitive health and brain health.
It helps. Really?
Right.
That seems absolutely counterintuitive because ketamine really screws
and
them
so
makes
the,
them happy.
If you haven't given ketamine, sometimes people become delirious with
yes.
ketamine, have hallucinations. And we're really talking about low-dose ketamine,
yeah.
well less than half a milligram per kilogram.
Okay.
And given before incision. Not,
so does that
it does.
Something?
It does. Actually, can,
before incision?
It does. There's actually... studies out there showing that postoperative pain scores at 3, 6, and 12 months out before after for colorectal surgery and spine surgery,
yeah.
a bolus of ketamine before incision causes patients to report less pain at all those time points.
Today's show is brought to you by the folks at CRNA Financial Planning, an independent consulting firm that offers financial planning services exclusively to CRNAs and their families. From planning for a child's future college expenses to building a predictable income stream in retirement, the firm is committed to offering you comprehensive financial services customized to fit your unique needs and objectives. If you have questions about your financial future, get them answered. Call the team at 855-304-3748. That's 855-304-3748. Or go online to crnafinancialplanning.com.
Yeah, I call this voodoo medicine. Whenever I first went back to the hospital after 16 years and they're doing this mag drips and Precedex, you know, I'd never had any exposure to yeah. these types of things. And I'm standing in the recovery room with a syringe of fentanyl. Like, they're going to be screaming, I'm going to be ready. And it's voodoo medicine, but it's amazing.
Oh, I want to say two things in defense of ketamine here, too, because I know
I love ketamine.
I do, too, but I know a lot of people have strong feelings about
it. It took
ketamine.
Me a long time to love it again. I had somebody win a systole on induction, a ketamine induction, and it scared. You know, it changes
yeah.
your practice.
It does. Ketamine has this reputation of having the flashback or these mm-hmm. prolonged effects. We actually think what's happening is if you give the ketamine before the incision, you're protecting the brain from having received the pain signals in the first place.
Yeah, well, that's why how our regional
okay.
works. They say that if
okay.
you have regional, you have cut that pain pathway out.
Correct.
Your brain doesn't get that pain signal,
right.
so it doesn't
so
it know
doesn't
what
it... So it
doesn't
pick it up.
Yeah.
Right.
And,
gotcha.
And that's
makes
how
sense.
Regional works.
If the tree falls in the wood and no one's around to hear it, it didn't make a noise.
It,
if the
yeah.
pain signal doesn't actually get to the brain can't
yeah.
hear the pain signal. Does it know pain?
Yeah.
Huh. And the other thing
it's
going
cool
on,
stuff.
Wow, that is pretty cool.
For delirium cognition, we know that unique amongst the IV anesthetics, ketamine increases intracranial blood flow.
Yes.
And we think that may be actually like somewhat brain protective. You're getting good oxygenation to your brain during the time of the surgery.
So are you advocating that maybe we all need to think about using ketamine before?
It has its place.
Okay.
Yeah, everything has to be tailored to the patient.
Yeah, well, I get that. But, you know, even whenever I worked in plastics and all of the stuff at first started coming out about. Now, I didn't give it before with induction. I would give it before incision.
Correct.
And even on my breast implants, I mean, they wake up happy anyway, but they were really happy with ketamine and new boobs. My God.
And I think if you can give patients benzodiazepines or propofol prior to the ketamine administration, actually let it circulate for a minute or two, then the likelihood of not having dysphoria from that is better.
So this isn't euphoria. This isn't just surgical procedures dealing with the brain. I mean, this is...
That's actually the great question. I'd love to take that and go with it. Once I got into looking at this information, actually, the inflammatory processes started by the surgical incision were impacting the brain regardless of the surgery.
Interesting. So the minute that receptor goes from wherever the surgical site is up to your brain, that's it.
That seems to be causing disruptions in the blood-brain barrier.
Look at that, the non-CRNA.
I know, that's
that
good.
Up. Are you not impressed?
What's so funny about this is that I can follow it because it's very logical.
Sure.
I mean, this is logical progression.
I'm watching your brain, work. You just want to put a mathematical equation.
That's right.
But what we're saying goes in the face of common sense. You're saying it's not the anesthesia that went to the brain that's making them loopy?
Yeah.
No, I'm not. That could be happening.
Sure.
But I'm saying that surgical insult to the body causes activation of all kinds of inflammatory mediators like interleukins, cytokines, tissue necrosis factor, many, many.
All right, surgeons.
Go to the brain.
Hear this? Everything that happens in the room is always the anesthesia's fault, and we get the blame for everything.
Well, I mean, it's just like fight or flight. I mean, you know, this is kind of the most basic human.
Very good point.
You know, it's...
Very
what
good.
The cavemen went through, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And so the blood-brain barrier is a super important protective sort of shield for the brain and the spine. It's two layers. It's the astrocytes, the shield cells with tight junctions around the nerves, and it's the endothelium of the vasculature, which is a little different than in the periphery of the body, keeping toxins and metabolites and some medications from going to the brain, which is what you want. That's an awesome thing.
Right.
And if that gets disrupted from trauma or inflammation or sepsis, these toxins, these metabolic byproducts that go into the brain and start wreaking havoc.
Wow.
So it could be the surgeon's fault.
It is definitely in part the surgeon's fault, but surgery is necessary.
Yeah.
You know, what's the alternative though? You know, that's the thing.
What should we be thinking about? What should we do? How can we prevent this? Because it's going to ultimately, we're going to get blamed for it. It's honest to God truth. And you and I both know it.
And even if we're not blamed for it, we need to take ownership of it.
Yeah.
If there's things that we can do to promote the health of the patient, even though it's not something we cause, like the antibiotic is not a part of the anesthesia. We give that because we don't want the patient to have the infection.
Right. Right.
So there might be a whole bunch of other things we could do. The answer is not sexy.
Okay.
And the presentation says it's also not sugammadexy. There's no magic bullet. There's not one medication we can give that sort of prevents this delirium or this neuroinflammation from occurring. And it's important to realize, like, inflammation is also necessary. Like, to heal, your body needs that inflammation to bring your tissues together to attract clotting mechanisms, et cetera. Interestingly, the single greatest thing that seems to be keeping people from going into greater extent of delirium is intensive reorientation in the PACU environment. The quicker we can get them with their family.
Really?
The quicker we can make sure pain control is super important.
Every time Pierce is woken up, they come and get me immediately.
That may be the single best thing they could do.
See, I told him I was the best thing that ever happened to him. Now I know I am.
You have this beautiful southern voice.
Yeah.
And if he were to not hear a voice that sounds like that.
That makes sense.
That may be not comfortable. It smells.
If Tracy was there, he wouldn't like it. That's what he's saying.
I make a joke in my presentation, but actually it's true. Like, there could be benefit just having dogs and back you.
No,
just
like absolutely agree.
Service dogs, Labrador retrievers, something calm. Something calm.
That's a great idea.
But the visceral emotional reaction to that animal and touching the animal and seeing
drives me crazy in the operating room when a patient's waking up and having a little emergence delirium and everybody is screaming at them, you gotta lay down, and pushing on them, and that would not
make you feel good.
No, and I'm like, everybody be quiet. Only one voice needs to speak. And it doesn't necessarily need to be me. What I have found is most people will respond to a male voice I mean, it happens with children. You can tell a child to keep doing something. Stop that, stop that. But let a man go, stop that. And they'll stop immediately. So mm-hmm. I always have one person who's a man. Only he can speak. I don't even speak. Just them. But it annoys the crap out of me when they start screaming. I'm like, they can't help it. Don't keep yelling at them.
I mean, that's a good point. But I was just thinking, you know, as you were talking, Adam, and I don't know because I've never been in the back of you, but, you know, just listening to you, you know, what about if it was a calming environment in the back of you and you played a little jazz music and you had a dog there, you had family, you know, and it was just, and it was a kind of an easing back in. I mean,
even
are there
some of the nursing meetings now, they're having puppies in their exhibit hall so people can come and rub the puppies.
Interesting.
Well, what you're saying is exactly it. And there are also some other key clinical features like nutrition, pain control, sleep.
Right.
Yes.
And getting people to sleep in the hospital is horrible.
It is.
Horrible. But some of the meds you could give them sleep can actually contribute to delirium from that anesthesia pathway, like Ambien.
Yes.
There is another medicine out there they're experimenting. We are using it, called suvorexant. It impacts another neurotransmitter of the brain called the orexin. It goes orexin. And just, it's like super powerful melatonin. It just puts people into a sleep cycle. It doesn't give them delirium. Mm-hmm. So there's things we need to keep investigating.
Mm-hmm.
But music, what if you only speak Spanish and all the voices you're hearing in English, you don't actually know what people are telling
you? Freaks you out.
Yeah.
What if you have baseline dementia or confusion anyway, and you're really hurting and you don't know how to express that? So you're trying to wake up, you're trying to orient, but all you're feeling is pain. There's so many factors that can play into why somebody's having trouble.
One of my daddy, I'm going back to him, after he had his thoracotomy, and he would sundown. And he was getting out of that hospital. They had to call security on him. They would call me in the middle of the night. I finally had to hire sitters for him because he was like, I'm going home. And they're like, they'd call me and they'd go, Ms. Spears, your daddy's trying to escape again.
But
the nicest nurse that he had, he would see deer running across the roof of the building next door. Or he saw a crane on the top of a building. It was crazy. It was very alarming for me to see him like that. But this one nurse was terrific with him. And I said, where's this coming from? She said, I have an autistic child, and everybody sees their world their way, and your daddy's seeing the world his way. And she was lovely with him. But that's not my lens, because I've never dealt with an autistic child, but that made her such a compassionate provider in that sense.
100%. I'm going to tell you right now, CRNAs, we are impatient. We expect to give a medication, see a response. I want my blood pressure up. I gave you, you have a problem. You should be able to solve it immediately. But this is not an immediately solvable problem.
Well, I think it goes back to your words, the production pressure. And we cater to that.
Yeah, we do.
We cater to that because it's an outside force pushing in.
What does it come down to, Sharon? What do I always say?
I know.
What am I doing?
All about the money, money, money.
So maybe we pay attention to the Beers criteria. We select anesthetics that sort of minimally impact the brain.
Mm-hmm.
We avoid some things that we know are pro-inflammatory. And then we work with the surgeon, the PACU nurses, the floors on anti-delirium pathways. And these are actually starting to show up. And the University of California, San Francisco is a leader in this, and other people are starting to copy them. And it's kind of like an ERAS protocol in a way, like all the way from before surgery to the end, optimizing the experience for the patient. But in this particular case, it's around brain health.
I mean, it's really your care plan, your anesthetic care plan. And are the students being trained this way now, or is this something that is so relatively new that it's not made its way down yet?
I don't think this is well taught. I don't think it's well taught to doctors or nurses.
Okay.
I was actually looking around at agendas for other conferences, looking at ANA and CNA. I don't think this has been presented to one of our groups recently.
You need to put an abstract in for Congress.
Well,
I think you should.
Well, and I would want to do it as part of a team, because there's Dr. Berger and Dr. Devaney and Dr. Matthew at Duke. We have a primary researcher, Nicola Tirando, Italian man, awesome. I mean, they are really leaders in this field as well.
Hey, CRNAs, it's time to simplify your continuing education. Welcome to CRNAEducation.com, your trusted provider for CPC core modules and a plethora of Class A CE credits. You can explore 43 detailed articles covering various anesthesia topics, all from your favorite device, anytime, anywhere. and with over 40 pharmacology CE credits, meet your state board requirements effortlessly. Whether you need a few credits or everything to recertify, we have what you need. Just complete your credits online without any subscriptions or recurring charges. You can trust in our 100% CRNA-owned platform, established in 2011, ensuring you receive the best in customer service and educational content. Ready to learn? Go to crnaeducation.com, making continuing education easy and accessible. And don't forget that support is always a quick email or a text or phone call away. To sign up and learn more, just go to crnaeducation.com.
Link in with the BIS monitor with all this. I remember a number of years ago there was some research about elderly people and you needed to keep their BIS higher.
Yeah.
I mean, normally most of us keep it around 40 or whatever, and that they need a higher BIS.
I keep my BIS turned up a little higher than that, just so you know.
So you are speaking to one of the most sort of confounding problems going on here. The anesthesia provider wants a number.
Yeah,
they want
they
the magic bullet. They want the thing. How can I impact it? I need something to work with. And so because we're talking about brain health, the BIS is what people turn to. It's like, well, that's the thing that's telling me about the brain. And the BIS has some really great
still an indirect
uses. It's
measure.
Indirect. It is very good at preventing recall for all patients.
Right.
Pre-demented, not demented is good at preventing recall. It's really good at dialing in a level of anesthesia.
Mm-hmm.
40 to 60 is generally the range.
Sure.
There are physiologic changes in the elderly that cause the numbers to go up a little bit, which sometimes causes the anesthesia providers to turn up the anesthesia because they want the number to go down. You should probably be permissive with the older patient, allowing for a higher BIS.
Okay.
At Duke, we actually, in our hip fracture bundle, we recommend a BIS of 70, with 40 to 60 being the standard range.
That would give me a
right, but we're not seeing the recall.
Okay,
and but we also know because probably reduction of brain mass in the elderly and maybe changes to the muscle of the forehead as well that the signaling for elderly patients 65 and older is changing.
Well,
and
there was some question about the BIS and use of ketamine.
Yes,
I mean, so are your numbers a true reflection?
Ketamine will increase your BIS. Beta blockers will decrease your BIS.
Yes,
if you give somebody a nice little beta blocker, they're not sleepier, but they're body's relaxing and the BIS lowers a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a perfect tool and it is not predictive of delirium. Congress has passed a second bill called the Enact Act, which jumped onto a bill they passed around 2016. I think this bill actually passed in 22. Between the two of them, there's now over $300 million of research money available for cognitive health research, with Alzheimer's being a big piece of it, but perioperative researchers are jumping on this and getting access to this money as well. There's huge studies going on right now to determine, is TEVA better than gas? Is one gas better than another gas? Mm-hmm. Is regional no sedation better? Oh, big studies, big, huge randomized controlled trials, and they're pretty awesome. A huge one right now is the THRIVE study. It won't be completed until 2028, and it's looking at sevoflurane versus propofol. But what we know is that actually none of it seems to matter so far.
Okay.
If you do a regional combined, TEVA with gas, or TEVA without no regional gas, the delirium rates are the same. Which that was one of the hurdles I had to get over. Is like, well, what's causing this then? If it doesn't matter what I'm doing, what's causing this? And that's led to this understanding what's going on with the surgery, the surgical stress.
Interesting. Wow. So, Adam, you you mentioned a painter in your presentation. Tell us a little bit more about that.
I did. His name is William Uttermolen. He's an American man from Philadelphia, and he was a portraitist. He made a living as a portraitist. I don't think he's the most famous painter. And probably what he will be best known for in history is a series of self-portraits that he purposefully, intentionally started when he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease in his 60s. Mm. And so I believe he was diagnosed in 96. He stopped being able to paint in 2000, entered a nursing home, and I think he died around 2005. And so there's a series of self-portraits that he makes over 5 years that change. Mm. The quality of the image changes, the precision of the image changes, the emotional content of the image changes. And so I wanted to present that as like a timeline of delirium and loss of self, loss of your mind, losing one's mind, loss of cognitive function. At the end of my presentation, I put all the pains in a row. It's like almost like the smiley faces of pain.
Right.
You see the changes here. I find it personally interesting because is this his loss of technique because he's losing motor control?
Skills.
Or is this him messaging us, like, this is how I feel? Because he really starts to look trapped. He even has like bars and window appearing things around his face mm-hmm. as he progresses? Or is it a combination? Like, is he actually losing control so he can't, he's painting to the top of his ability and he's trying to tell us something? But there's this loss of identity. His early work is almost like photographs. He's with a pencil and he's making photorealistic portraits. There's one I presented of him, a self-portrait with a pencil, and he's a handsome man. And his anatomy alters. It's not proportional. It's angry. It's hurt. It's lost. And then as the portraits continue on towards 2000, the features of the anatomy fall off. He no longer has eyes. His nose right. is just a bump. And it's still artful. I mean, even his final portrait is probably better than I could ever do.
Sure.
At my right. top of my artistic ability. And there's emotion in it. It just added an emotional depth of without having patience, I can show you right now, of what's this like, this loss of self.
Yeah.
So as we kind of wrap this up, another thing you talked about in your lecture yesterday was hard and soft outcomes and how anesthesia providers can affect those. So why don't you elaborate on that?
I think this is really important. Anesthesia and our basic science community have done awesome work improving the safety for surgery and anesthesia with equipment. We have ultrasounds, video laryngoscopes, quantitative monitors for our paralytics, hard numbers that we can work with, manipulate, and be very precise what's happening with our patient. And that's fantastic. And I think we've done really good with hard outcomes that are not necessarily equipment, but just our ability to control your blood pressure, our ability to control your blood sugar, numbers that we're working with. We should be super proud of this. Anesthesia has gotten so much safer. Mm-hmm. And we need to keep on developing these things. There's more to do. Where I think the doctors and nurses of anesthesia need to continue to improve, and I think our necessary trajectory, our necessary evolution for improvement is on soft outcomes. Things where the score, if it's numbered at all, is relative, like pain control, the experience of nausea. We've done a lot with pain control. Mm-hmm. We've done a lot with nausea. I think the biggest thing we're going to see over the next 15, 20 years is attempts to quantify this brain health topic I'm presenting on.
Your population is aging. The baby boomers, how many baby boomers are reaching retirement age a day? It's in the thousands a day.
Yeah.
So our clientele is definitely trending older.
I'm a big believer in all anesthesia models, autonomy, anesthesia care team model.
Sure.
They all have their uses.
Absolutely.
They all have successes.
Right.
Those of you who are listening who want to be standing on your own, have that autonomy, you need to listen to me clearly because your choices are going to be observed and noted as these sorts of awarenesses and tracking and research and monitoring develops. You need to be able to interact with this and think about promoting the future healthier patient after the OR.
Mm-hmm. Well, that'd be a great study for the foundation. Well, Adam, I mean, I even found this extremely enlightening, you know, even not being a healthcare professional. I mean, there was a lot of this that I could even follow. So, you know, all the CRNAs listening who are a whole lot smarter than me are going to get this, and you did such a great job, as you always do, kind of breaking it down and so forth. And if people want to learn more about this, we'll put Adam's contact information out there. And or if they want to have you come to their meetings and speak, or
which you should,
you know, or
he's excellent.
Yeah, so we appreciate you being on the show for the second time.
Thank you,
and
I enjoy being here.
Thank you for all the work that you're doing out here for the CRNA community, on top of the 180 plus CRNAs that you oversee as chief of Duke. And Sharon, I think it's a wrap.
I think so.
Well, I am Jeremy Stanley.
Well, good for you.
Yes. And you are?
I don't know. Why don't you tell them?
Did you forget?
My name is Sharon Pierce.
Well, we want to thank our listeners for listening to the show. And Sharon, how can they help us grow? Because we do need to grow. Everybody needs to grow. But how can they help us?
Well, share us on social media. Tell all of your friends.
You really do have dysphoria this morning. You stay off those rooftop bars.
Well, I don't know. Alcohol might do the same as anesthesia drugs. But anyway, tell all your friends. We grow by word of mouth. We're in the top 50 medical podcasts in the country, on the way to number
one, just like we are in the CRNA community right now. We're the number one podcast for CRNAs out there. And we couldn't do it without our listeners and great content like Adam here.
Exactly.
And
keep sending these people our way.
That's right. Absolutely. Until next time.
It's a wrap.
Hi, Hi, this is Jackie Rolls, president of the International Federation of Nurse Anesthetists and president and founder of Our Hearts, Your Hands, a global anesthesia support community that takes donations to allow nurse anesthetists in low and middle income countries to go to educational programs, buy equipment, or textbooks. Your donations are tax deductible, and we would appreciate your support.
Be sure to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and anywhere you like to listen to shows. Also, be sure to check out beyondthemaskpodcast.com. Each episode is posted there with a corresponding blog post, and we timestamp important parts of the episode to help you quickly get to the content you're looking for. Also, check out the special series section on the site. You can follow along and catch up on the CRNA History Series, episodes specifically about political conversations in the industry, or try the CRNA Personal Finance Series. It's all on beyondthemaskpodcast.com. And if you have a question for the show or want to be a guest or even suggest a particular topic, fill out the contact form on the site or send an email directly to us at info@beyondthemaskpodcast.com. And lastly, let's take the conversation social. Check out our Beyond the Mask podcast Facebook page and Facebook group.